everyone, to episode 8 of Malazan FM podcast, and today we are finishing Gardens of the Moon, first ever book finishing, which promises to be very exciting. We have quite the rollicking climax to finish off this first Book of the Fallen.
Sure do.
Yes, so we start off with another of Erickson's good poems. This one's about the feet, the one marking the beginning of the new year. It's a bit reminiscent, actually, of this festival they had back in Rome, Lupercalia, where they had these boys running around with wolf furs. And here we have the priestesses race down the streets, the strips of wolf fur streaming from their hands. I find interesting. And it ends with, It is as if the gods themselves pause their breath, which is quite a dramatic lead-in and reflects what's going to happen.
Well, there you go. Today I learned a bit of a real-world education. History. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry, Mike.
No, that's great. That's great.
Classicalism kind of leads into things. And it's something I noticed, too, just now. Anyway. So the chapter itself opens with actually a poem by a character we are going to read next episode, one Hiboric, about the matron who birthed the dragons, and dragons do figure a lot in this climax. So The chapter itself opens with Murillo, our favorite rascal, who's thinking about this wheel, this big stone disc.
He's worried about the upcoming fate and the condition of Ralik, whether or not they're going to be able to go through with the plan.
And we have a bit of a reflection on this huge stone wheel in Majesty Hall, where the Durujistan Council meets, and apparently, like, he gives the names to the years, and this year has the ominous enough name of the Year of the Moon's Tears. Which I think I could figure out what it refers to, but I think we'll keep that between us for now.
Yeah, that's some way away.
Yes. And we also hear another character who will play a lot of a big role very soon, one Icarium, who brought this wheel to Dojistan in the companion of a Trell and was a Jakut. Now, which I find it's very cool how you have these offhand mentions of characters who don't even appear and have, like, almost no role. But
yeah, there's quite a lot of that in these closing chapters. We get a lot of sort of characters name dropped for the upcoming books, which is, I mean, some of them don't crop up again for quite some time.
Oh, yeah.
But more on that later, I think.
Yes, so that I like how there are these scholars who are already, like, thinking, like, linking Moonspawn and Year of the Moon's Tears, and it's nice that someone in these fantasy books actually notices, like, oh, it's just like in this prophecy, right? Because all the time people are saying, oh, the prophecy will never happen, yeah. Like, they don't know they're living in a book.
Yeah, and it'd be kind of weird if there's a year called Moon's Tears and there's a giant floating castle called Moonspawn above the city and no one made the connection. So it's nice that sort of they acknowledge that.
Yes, Murillo's walking around and he enters our favorite haunt, the Phoenix Inn, and there he meets Krupp. Then they start talking about the feet, of course. It's spelled F-E-T-E with this weird French circumflex on the first E because it's a French word.
I'd pronounce that fate.
But teach his own, I guess. I like on the side. It kind of reminds me how Erickson kind of digs up these really obscure words like fate and. The name for that thing that happened in the beginning of the book when at Peo, where everyone got decimated, that was called the Enfilade. And I had zero idea what an Enfilade was until it came up in Malazan. Mm-hmm. And he's just being surrounded and decimated, as you might guess. Krupp and Murillo are talking about the feat. Murillo has procured an invitation for Krupp. And suddenly, Murillo confronts Krupp with an accusation that he's figured out who he really is. Which brings us to my favorite line of the book. Perhaps I'll just have to read it out loud. Copyright, forgive me. Aye! Krupp cried, withdrawing. I'll not deny it, then. It's true, Murillo. Krupp is Lady Simtal, connivingly disguised. Yes, I think it's, in this specific book at least, it's Krupp's finest hour. But right after this, Murillo gets to more serious business, and he points out that he discovered that Krupp is in fact the eel, the mysterious spy master who's been manipulating Dirujistan behind the scenes. But Krupp kind of confuses him with a spell, and yeah, that's it. And Mu goes. And the next scene is Baruch.
He's trying to persuade Rake not to go to the party, but Rake really wants to go.
Yeah, and it's he's saying that he would be it's kind of silly to go just as himself, to see a MDI warlord. But he said that no one will recognize, Rake says that no one will recognize him, which is true because, in Gardens of the Moon for some reason, no one knows anything about, the Tist MDI for some reason. I'm not sure why.
Yeah, I mean, it's, even if they don't recognize him, he's certainly going to catch the eye.
He's
pretty tall, broad.
Huge sword.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes you hide in plain sight.
Yeah. Besides, yeah. I think at this stage, he's pretty much, things are starting to wind up. He's grown tired of hiding. He just wants to see what's going on, get his feet on the ground.
Yeah, when you have to flying so much. And, yeah, so even Rake, he notes the coincidence. It's the year of the moon's tears. It says, Lord and Amanda Rake stiffened. So I again like that pretty realistic moment. It's like
I like the way Baruch tries to dismiss it because it was it's the wheel's 800 years old and there's no sort of prophecy there and or 1,000 years old and Rake says, well, you know, I met Ikarium 800 years ago and
I knew this guy. He knew everyone apparently. And apparently he hung around with Ostrich and Calban Brood when he was visited by Ikarium, apparently he used to hang around, Rake used to hang around with this Ostrich guy till they had gone to an argument, and I actually don't remember what this argument was about, what that all was about, so I have to mark it down to watch out for details on it, which I'm sure they're there somewhere in the series.
I think this is the first mention of Ossirk, so
yes,
up to now we wouldn't know what that is, and I'm still not entirely sure. I'm sure they've got plenty to argue about, but...
Ray kind of like falls into his memories when the servant knocks on the door, tells Baruch that he's going to go to the feet. Anyway, so... Mammoth has apparently woken from his coma when he was trapped in the Amtos Falak. Which is kind of weird when I think of what happens to him next. It's maybe a bit deceptive. And finally, Baruch finds out who the coin bearer is. That's, of course, Crocus. And kind of like slaps his head. He's like, oh!
Because I think someone mentions the name to him earlier, and he doesn't make the connection that it's Mammoth's nephew.
Yes. So then the passage kind of cuts off with one of those dramatic kind of foreshadowing things that it was his first mistake of the day. And then we cut to Lorne, who was watching the feet go on, and it's kind of just walking around, describing things, and then Circle Breaker at the gate. He talks to this old guy to this old guy who's bitter over having to be a guard instead of being with his family at the festival. So Circle Breaker cunningly offers to replace him or to watch the proceedings. And what kind of annoys me is like it ends with Circle Breaker telling this guy his name, but of course Erickson is only teasing us and doesn't actually tell us what the name was, which is a bit annoying.
Yeah.
So Yeah, man, Zuckerberg is one of the more mysterious people in this book, so I guess it makes sense. Anyway, so then Lorne goes to the bar, meets a Fiddler and Hedge playing with the deck of dragons. They're playing some game that Fiddler is making up as they go along.
Yeah,
which is very funny.
It's interesting because it's kind of part game, part divination.
Yes, if you pay attention to what their eyes are saying, yeah, I think it's a bit of divination. And it kind of sets a trope for Fiddler. He's always using the deck, and it kind of sets that up. Then she talks to Wesley. Jack comes in, and they talk. They note that Sally's disappeared. So, Whiskey Jack tells them what the plan is, which is they've been hired, the Bridgewoodners have been hired to be guards at the Lady Sentinel's feet, tonight. And, apparently it's been set up by one Mr. Trotz, the bar guest, and, kind of notes the appeal of barbarian, like watching the nobles as the party.
He's not just a guard, he's also a sort of an odyssey. Yeah, so yeah. something for the nobles to gawp at while they're having fun at the party.
Yeah. Oh, I love the word gawp. It's amazing. And then we have again Procus and Absalar. Talking about Urdistan and Unta, and somehow Absalar remembers that Unta is like the Malzahn capital. She's talking about she doesn't know how she knows it, and it must be a strange place, the mind of Absalar. Like, she's got her memories, then there's some of the rope's memories still in her brain. It's got to be a very odd place.
Yeah, she's got sort of a weird case of kind of amnesia with little bits, sort of little pertinent bits of information just keep popping through, and she sort of doesn't understand where it's coming from and all the rest. So,
they're looking for, Crocus intends to find Chalice and talk to her about the death warrant that her family has apparently issued for him. And of course, he suspects Absalar being jealous and stuff. And of course, they're being watched by Surratt, the most unlucky Tistian DI in history.
She's still not having much luck at this taking care of the coin bearer business, is she?
Yeah, it's almost like she has like this magnetic clash because, you know, Corcus has all the luck, then she has all the bad luck or something. Anyway, so just as she's about to attack him, somebody like captures her, like almost kills her, and tells her there's the last warning for the prince to rake, don't touch the coin bearer. And in classic Erikson style, we're not told explicitly who it is, but of course Surratt would know. We're kind of, it's one of those things where Erikson kind of drops us into like the real world where they don't explain things at the time. But it's more of a narrative thing to keep a mystery rather than realism. And of course, touching on the theme from last week of being saved without knowing about it. Then there's the customary passage where Crocus is like, oh, did you feel that? Nah, I must have been imagining things. jumping at shadows. And after that, we get a flashback to the early life of one race, who is our Jakku tyrant we've all been living in fear of. And basically, he was like a weirdo mutant Jakku who has the desire to rule people. But exactly because of this kind of thing, the Jakku like live alone and didn't have societies because they're afraid of tyranny. And basically, because of this, his own mom disowned him with this weird ritual. And then he started his own empire by enslaving some Imas, becomes basically their god. And I like this little comment where it says that the priest who worshipped him oppressed the people just like he oppressed them, which is a nice commentary which applies to the real world. But
yeah, and he takes a lot of joy in that fact. What does he say? The cosmic irony that he could only shake his head at.
Yeah, it's
like sort of like he couldn't have made it any better. Even if he'd planned it to happen like that, it couldn't have been any better. The fact that he's subjugating them and they're subjugating the others, and it's just this vicious circle of...
But eventually he gets attacked by the other Jakku, who basically put an end to his tyranny and imprisoned him in the barrel where he's been until now. He's basically from his point of view, and now he's going to go after the finesse, which has his all his power, which is in Jurjistan. It ends with him like walking out of the barrow, which is it's a pretty cinematic kind of moment, like when the mummy emerges into the light, right?
Yeah. He fires tons of earth into the sky, while Crone watches on, cackling with glee.
Cackling, yeah. She's a weird bird. And then she starts screaming in this weird language, which, something about Draconius or whatever. I think it's just gibberish, honestly, because Erkson's, he's not Tolkien. He doesn't invest time in making the languages. It sounds a bit like Latin. Well, what does it? The day of the Tisti MBI had come. And so we have again, we go back to Raist. He's exulting in his own reborn power, starts torturing Bern, the sleeping goddess, which is she's young as far as she's concerned. And you know, this whole Bern sleep thing, you know, which is like how the dating system works for some reason, I can't establish why. Like all the years on since Bern went to sleep, and she's like the earth goddess. Which, you know, when I first, like, read the series, I kind of thought Bern sleep would be like, it was in Hebrew, so it kind of sounded like it was like after a nuclear war, like burning. So I thought the Mazan was going to be kind of like that, like very early on. Just on the side.
But he decides not to wake her up, just to hurt her. So. And he's causing these massive earthquakes as he sort of reaches down and gives her a poke.
Yeah, kind of a cosmic poke. Then the dragons attack him, led by one Silana, who lives in Moonspawn. And of course, there's lots of kind of special terminology exchanged, which the newbies doing. Are kind of like, what? Soul Taken this, Jughood, Tiam. It's one of those moments that's designed for the reader, even though it doesn't have much insight, but it's kind of incomprehensible. In fact, I think when this whole climax is kind of, one of the oldest, bigger faults in this book is kind of like how in the climax everything gets kind of cluttered up and weird things happen and like no one understands.
There's things in terms and sort of events that happen and sort of terms that get thrown around in this book that we don't get sort of a definition or an explanation for until sort of sometimes four or five books down the line. So that's just one of those things. But I enjoyed that about these books. I like the sense of it being part of this huge sort of world that you don't know what's going on and you're sort of dropped in the middle of it and you just have to try and sort of make do as best you can as you plod your way through.
Yes. Basically the Chavaka zooms on, they fight, he hurts the edge, wounds the dragons a lot, and that's the end of the chapter. The next chapter, we have Lorne with Nate, begins the, what I call the mini acorn saga, aka from small acorns grow huge mysteries, which I'll kind of expound on later. Basically, she's walking around this garden near where the fate is, and she basically plants the acorn, which is the finest, which has the tyrant's power. And then she inevitably starts reflecting on kind of mortality, and she's like thinking about all these people who are celebrating now are going to die when the bridge burners blow up everything. Celebration of insignificance. Is that all we are in the end? And then she realizes that one day she's going to be dead too, and she's like, she's like cracking and breaking down. She's kind of a despondent woman right now.
Yeah, she seems sort of quite conflicted about what she's doing and I think we got more of it when she was leaving the Barrow last time round, where she's sort of not sure if she's on the right path or what's going on. And then she sort of shakes all that off and she's like, I am the adjunct. I am the will of the Empress.
Is she a person or is she just an extension of the Empress? So, then they have Krupa again, who thinking about his plans. One of those more introspective sections. And then again, Crocus, another scene, Crocus this time. And kind of Apsol asks him, well, what will you do if Chalice betrays you again? And he's kind of like, oh crap, I didn't think about that. And he wonders if she was like trying to insult him. Anyway, so it's still dark. They finally come out of the Kuril's Tower, the Kuril's Belfry, and move towards the fleet. And then there's a bit of a funny scene where the captain of the Sintal's guard basically is talking to the Bridgeburners and like giving them instructions of what to do for the night. And he says like, "Oh, I thought you were all Barghast." And it turns out that Trotz gave his name as Naganga.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's like Whiskey Jack's like this. Then Trotz is like Naganga. Yes.
Yeah, he just gives him a sort of funny look.
Yeah, that was funny. So he's basically telling them that their back's gonna be to the garden. It's just no funny business. No one let anyone get past to the garden. Blah blah blah. Quickman's really scared of the approaching storm, which we know is actually Tiger Tyrant coming for his finest. Then we have Callan and Perrin. They're basically going to give an offer to Vorkin, the master of the Assassin's Guild. I think they say now that if they make the offer in the Empress's name, then the Empress has to pay, and if they like rebel because it's in her name, which I don't know how true that would be. If I were the Empress, I wouldn't honor some random. I would like say, oh, it's null and void because some rebel made the offer. But
I think the deal is that if someone makes an offer in her name, she basically has to honor it, because otherwise future offers that are made in her name become empty. So if they move on to the next town and they're trying to sort of get the Assassin's Guild in that town to kill off all the mages or whatever, and they say, oh, the Empress will pay you all this money, and then they go, well, that's what you told the guys in Darujastan, but it didn't really pan out like that.
Yeah.
So I think she's kind of, because of the way they operate, she's kind of forced to honor these agreements.
Yeah. So I guess if it's true, it's pretty clever. Callum starts, at the end of the scene, Callum's like, something about the gray faces is bothering him, which we'll see on soon. There's another short scene with Baruch and Rake, which are talking, thinking about things. There's a lot of these kind of scenes which are kind of introspective. Anyway, so then they arrive at the fleet, and Simtal, they kind of freaks out when she sees Rake, and she's like, "How many men do you know who are 7 feet tall and have a sword?" And I guess she already has a suspicion. Though he does have a mask, which looks like a black dragon. Not simply enough.
So subtle.
Yeah. No, I don't think a Rake is a very subtle soul. He doesn't really need it. And they even give his name. Baruch even gives his, total name, Lord Anamander Rake. And apparently no one knows that he's, the Lord of Moonspawn.
Yeah, so the Baruch sort of almost despairs. He's kind of like, this is a name known by poets and scholars, but not, it appears, by councilmen. Sort of the ignorance of the ruling class.
Yeah, yes. I guess, with what kind of holds true in the real world, it's like some random guy, some random count from 600 years ago suddenly showed up. I don't think many people recognize him. He hasn't been that involved in human affairs recently, at least not Darujastan affairs. He's just wandering the world looking for wars.
Yeah, I suppose that's fair enough. He is kind of a recluse.
Yeah, he's flying around. It's kind of like if the Man in the Moon came down. Well, it is the Man in the Moon. Anyway, so
so then we've got Murillo and Krupp with the Krupp's cherub mask, and Murillo the peacock, and Ralik the tiger. So that's quite interesting because obviously Ralik's a killer and Murillo's a sort of pretty boy who seems to make a living just by going around with various women. Yeah, playboy, that's the one.
He's a player. Then we find out, in the next scene, we find out that Baruch also has figured out that Krupa is the eel, and he introduces Krupa such to Rake, and he's like, and then Rake makes a little pun about it himself, about, like, the risks of oversight, you might say, because, so tall, And this kind of, it's this really vivid contrast because we have this, freakishly huge Rake and, this short, fat guy, which I can really, picture.
I like the way Rake sort of finds him, quite amusing.
Yeah, he's not made of stone. And then, I think, seen from Turban Orr's point of view, and I think at this juncture I just want to make a short observation that Turban Orr is the silliest non-joke name in this book. Turban Orr, it's like, do you want a turban or a mask? Like, what? of course it's Orr spelled with two R's, but and I think there are some people with that last name, but Turban? Seriously? So I'm kind of weird. Okay. Motivation. He basically waiting for confirmation that Carl's dead because he needs him out of the way. And then finally he meets a certain mysterious man who is none other than Ralik Nam, and they quickly run afoul of each other. And Ralik challenges them to a duel, and a turban like kind of like shaking and asking, "What's your name?" And Rake's like, "You're," and Ralik's like, "You're not fit to hear it." kind of taking this really theatric stance, and also Orr starts making these pronouncements, saying, "Oh, this guy who insulted me is going to be so dead," and I'm gonna kill you. And then Ralik's like, stop babbling. If I could kill you 1,000 times, it would not be enough.
There's some nice smack talk going on between these two. Yes. It's pretty good.
Now they have to find their seconds. There's like a second to the duel is like the guy who like has to continue the duel or something.
It's just sort of like a formality thing. They help them with the sword and getting the gear ready, and they observe that there's no sort of foul play. So as well as having a referee, you've also got the 2 seconds who sort of agree that it was a fair duel or whatever.
I'm witnesses kind of. Mr. Astracium Darley, who is the Chalice's father, is Turban Orr's second. And when Ralik is asked for his second, it is silent. We have one of those waiting for some guy to speak up with anger. Then we switch to Stimtal and an unnamed man lying in bed, And at the end of the second, after a bit of dialogue, we find out it's Murillo. Who else? And that's how we got the invitation for Krupa and all that. It's not one of my favorite scenes. I don't think romance and all that is really Erickson's forte, but it's functional, I guess. And finally, Rake decides to speak up, and he offers to be Ralik's second.
It's interesting that he's really getting himself involved at this party. He's not just sort of hanging back and observing. He's taking part in duels and meeting all the players.
He's kind of like the opposite of the Jaegu Tyrant. They're both kind of like this immortal, kind of detached kind of creature. But where raised to, he's all about dominating and uncaring. Rake does, he kind of keeps himself alive by kind of living through other people.
Yeah.
Which I guess I don't know about it. It's a very decent way to pass tens of thousands of years, I guess.
Yeah, he says something similar when he's talking to Baruch earlier yes. on when he's earlier talking about
like, mercenaries of the spirit. Yeah.
Yeah, how they sort of give themselves a sort of reason to carry on living by sort of taking on these causes.
Yeah. Mammoth has a hideous Jughead mask. And then where we have Secret Whiskey Jack's point of view of like Fiddler sort of like saying it's a duel. The guy with the worm stain on the shirt is one of them. That's Turbinort. And you know, it's kind of odd to see like real life slang like guy, like that guy. But you know, it's not as obtrusive as in some other places, like okay also shows up in this book once or twice, but I guess you could say it's like an idiomatic translation of original, but although of course yeah, it's not like Tolkien where he says like, oh, I translated this book from the Red Book of Westmarch, I think it's a bit of a trope, but they ever said that too, yeah. Apparently, unlike the nobility of Dojistan, Whiskey Jack recognizes Rake, well, of course, become Bala Pale, as he's like, they're like scared, like, oh my god, he's found us. They're still like, getting a good position for the blowing up stuff, and now we have Crocus looking for Chellis among the costumes. Well, of course, her costume wasn't much of a disguise because she's a bar guest war maid, basically, kind of, I guess.
Which sounds like it's quite a sort of skimpy outfit, because I think someone notices that she's outrageously dressed.
Yes, Barrett, yeah. It's kind of, that wouldn't be a very effective way for war maiden to dress, but sure. Anyway, so then instead of finding Chellis, he finds Krupp. He sees Krupp give a guard a message, compliments of a longtime secret admirer, and Crocus thinks it's like, oh, those guards have all the luck with noble ladies. Yeah, which is an understandable kind of thing. You know, you just hear this random bit of dialogue, you think, oh man. But then we suddenly shift to Circle Breaker, and he reads the message. And basically, you get it, apparently, the Krupp bought him a house in this other city, and he's basically, giving him lots of stuff. It's a pretty nice way to reward, guy's been spying for a time, and it's,
Which is interesting because Krupp never pays for a round in the Phoenix Inn, but somehow he's managed to, buy this guy a house filled with servants and all the rest.
Yeah. But it kind of stands out because it's not a common kind of thing you see in the Amazon universe, like this kind of, generosity. Baruch is gonna referee the duel between Turbin and, Ravik, Turbin starts kind of like jumping around, says like, how wound him here or there, should I cut him to pieces? The ladies will have to dance on slick, flagstones. He kind of mocks, he says, I'm gonna quickly kill Ravik, and, Estracy and, Charles' father says, like, this is, I oppose this duel as facile and trite. I find the councilman's life irrelevant in the best of times. This is saying he's not gonna take revenge. and then they, fighting, and, within basically, like, one paragraph, Ralph kills him, which is kind of a payback for this silly posturing he's been doing.
Yeah, I like the way they don't have sort of a long, drawn-out duel. It's just, like, a couple of parries and feints, and then stab, stab.
Yeah. So Ralex has, like, 1,000 other deaths would not have satisfied me, but I'll settle for this one. And then Ralex says, I think that was an uneven match. suddenly we meet a woman with a pipe. There's apparently one Witch Derudin, and I'm thinking, is she the same as that old woman who smokes a pipe all the time near Crocus's house?
The lady who gives the signal with the pipe who's always standing outside, I'd never made that connection before. It might just be that Darujastan's city overfilled with old ladies with pipes, but it seems like quite a sort of distinctive image. So I think it could be the same.
Yeah, it could be. And she's called a witch, which is accurate, but it just it doesn't seem to be any kind of derogatory term in the Mazda universe, witch. Just needs something that's really spells.
She doesn't sort of object to the title. She's quite happy to,
it's kind of jarring to the reader. It's like, oh, she's a witch.
Yeah.
Then there's more Krupa eating, as he does. And then Ralik, on the heels of killing Turbinor, he goes into Simtal's room and he starts to order around and say that her guards aren't going to help her, threaten her, and basically starts saying, "Call's alive," and basically tell her how her entire life is ruined, and he's kind of getting the revenge for Call this way. He tells her that Turbin's dead, and Morelia leaves with him, and it's very heavily implied that Simtal kills herself.
It's really ice cold the way he just gives her the dagger and walks out.
But he breaks down outside. "Mary, I think I'm lost. Am I lost? It's like even doing this justice, it kind of killed him inside. Like even though you thought that's what would keep alive, it actually ended up killing him inside his soul."
Yeah, so I'm guessing Mary's some kind of deity.
She's like this goddess, assassin's goddess, certainly, because thief goddess is Absalom. Finally, where Crocus finds Chalice and kind of drags her, and he turns kind of creepy. It's a bit unsettling. How he kind of drags Chalice into the darkness, this kind of creepy, rapey kind of thing, which is a kind of weird for a character or subjective. That's kind of the chapter ends. So then we have Circle Breaker's final scene, and he's thinks about himself, and he's he leaves, kind of leaves Darujastan behind, and he has this nice reflection. He's I've done my part, just another nameless stranger who couldn't run in the face of tyranny, which is a nice kind of capitulation of himself, just another nameless stranger who couldn't run from tyranny. He's a pretty good guy.
And he finally, I think this is the first time we see him smile right at the end. He just has a little smile as he walks off into the sunset.
It's another special skill of Erickson's, rapid characterization. A lot of these epic series, takes a while to, sympathize with the characters, but people Sicklebaker, in only one book, they have a complete arc, basically.
And he's only in sort of half a dozen scenes as well. We see him spying on Aura a few times and then sending and receiving messages, and then we see him here and that's it. But it's a nice sort of story, and he's just a normal guy who's done his part to get rid of this monster.
Yeah, one of the unique parts of of Gardens of the Moon, And, it kind of also, now thinking about this kind of skill, it reminds me of another of that kind of character quite far down the line in the series. If you're a rereader, I think you know who I'm talking about.
Is this, Reaper's Gale?
Yes.
Yeah.
So don't say we only, cater to stupid new readers who can't understand what they're reading. So that was now we're on to chapter 22, which opened with quite a lot of long poem about the ravens. And I like this little refrain, very poetic. "Shatter the day, O flags of night, rend with shadows this innocent light." It kind of showcases Erickson is also kind of a poet in addition to a prose writer. And we go back to Raist, basically burning everything in his path to Darujastan, and
he's still sort of engaged in this battle between him and the five dragons, is sort of drawing to a close.
He lets Silana escape, and then suddenly he kind of he steps, he gives like a wrong step, and goes into this wind-whipped mud flat, and he meets a tiny little mortal with a red coat and dress. And who would it be? And he's like, says, "Dear sir, you've not aged well at all." This is another more classic Krupa. He says, "Race also kind of notes how similar our humans are to IMAS." Krupa man gives him a bit of like this welcome to the future speech, where like you said, we don't care about you.
Yeah, so he tries to sort of trap Raced in his dream with the help of Karul.
And then Tool appears with a sword and kind of starts slicing up Raced with his huge sword. And apparently, that Pranch Old, the Tyrannomass from the past, who Krupp spoke to previously, helped from Mysticness.
That's right, with the soul shift for the Tattersail, he was there, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Krul shows up, and apparently he reminds Raced of Hood for some reason. And he tells him, like, "You do not exist." And then Krul's like, "Perhaps." He kind of, like, offers Raced to follow him to Chaos. Chaos is kind of like this kind of concept, which seems to have been basically forgotten after Guardians of the Moon. It doesn't really figure Miles on after that.
I think, it's sort of it comes up quite a bit in Memories of Ice.
Chaos?
Yeah, because there's stuff that we can't talk about at the moment which relates to it.
maybe. Anyway, so also, Krul notes that basically it's now that, mortals enslave gods now, and that's why anyone can beat Raced. Yeah, mortal could kill Raced. Apparently, at the end of the scene, turns out that Raced has found another body. And it's like, "Oh my," and the Krupp's like, "Oh my." Oh, yeah. So, we're getting quite long. This is probably going to be the longest episode so far. Anyway, so we've got Karam walking through the streets of Dirigistan, and he meets Karam and Absalar, and they're in the garden. And they look at this stone block which has emerged, and this is installment 2 of the Acorn Saga. It's like growing, it's growing wood. Apparently Absalar can remember Kalam as an old friend. Then the rest of the Bridgeburners show up, and they start talking about Absalar and her mind, and Mallet basically realizes there's someone else in there.
Yeah, in terms of the someone else who's there, I just want to draw people's attention to chapter 1.
Yes.
if you're wondering who that, the third person besides the rope and sorry is.
Could just say, but that would be a reread spoiler.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's not a spoiler, is it? Because it's already happened. It was the witch who was killed.
Yeah, it's kind of a reuse spoiler.
Yeah, she has a line where she says, "Riga will preserve you because we are linked, you and I." When she's talking about the shadow passing over the girl's soul. That's sort of, we've just come full circle from chapter 1 to wherever we are now.
Chapter 22.
Yeah.
After that, we have Relic and Krupa and suddenly a woman shows up, and that's Vorkin, the master of the guild. And it turns out that apparently Akalat was not ordered to kill Kaz, so it's okay that Relic killed him.
Which is kind of convenient, but...
I guess Vorkin just realized which way the wind was blowing.
Ralik just killed his sort of chapter leader, so she kind of is. And a lot of the assassins have been dying recently because of the tea standy have been hunting them, so she can't really afford to let someone of Ralik's skills go to waste.
Yes, she basically summons Ralik to a meeting. Meanwhile, we have Crocus and Chalice. And obviously kind of threatens her, but he doesn't really know what he's doing. And he basically questions her about, did he betray her? Did she betray him? And apparently not. It was actually Axelar who killed the guard back at the house. And she reveals
that she'd never actually they hired a seer and they knew that it wasn't him.
Yeah.
So we sort of, we know that Mies and Iralta have been kind of lying to Crocus to keep him indoors out the way.
Yes. And then he makes this kind of last desperate play for her. It's like saying, like, forget this Gorlass idiot. Within the year my uncle introduced us formally, Nahmot is a famous writer. And he's like, just some writer.
Yeah. Poor Crocus, he's gone to all this trouble to finally track down Chalice without any sort of game plan. He never knew what to do when he got hold of her, and she just kind of laughs at him and dismisses him out of hand.
All too realistic.
Amen.
So it's like, company, friendship, what am I saying? I'm a thief, I rob women like you. Basically... he kind of points out that Chalice doesn't know what the real world is like because she's rich and stuff. And then she says this kind of sad thing, I saw a man die tonight, and if that's what real means, I don't want it. Goodbye. So that's a bit of a melancholy goodbye. So not a kind of one-sided. Yeah. So now he's goes to find Absalar, and back to Mallet and the Bridgeburners, this is actually when Mallet points out that there's a third person inside of Absalar, and he's trying to save Riga.
That's right.
Two people enter. That's probably Ralik and Porkin. Crocus, who's in the garden looking up, so like basically witnesses this meeting between the Bridgeburners and the assassins, and essentially Kalam offers a contract for 900,000 Chakadas to kill all the Cabal. That's the mages who basically apparently rule Dorujistan, even though where do you even see them actually ruling? It's more like Krupa ruling than the EO, but okay. Afterwards, Ralik sees Crocus and tells him to go warn Nahmot and the other, and Baraka, the other mages, that, Porkin's gonna get them, and she's a high mage, so she can totally, kill them.
Yeah.
To get together.
And Crocus sees Absalar with the Bridgeburners as well, and thinks that, they've kidnapped her or something, because she looks sort of in a trance, he doesn't sort of make the connection that she's probably came to Darujistan with them in the first place, which, considering they're Malazans and she's from Itkokan, could make that connection, but it's sort of his head's swimming at the moment, so he doesn't really make that leap.
Mm-hmm. Rake is getting ready for the approach of the town, and he's like, Ray takes out his sword and tells everyone to get out of the way, so people just kind of like, you can almost see like that camera kind of like pan out, as he like, everyone's like screaming and running for their lives.
It's a pretty effective way of getting rid of a crowd, I suppose. Yes, just start waving a huge sword in the air.
So basically the, we see suddenly Mammoth kind of goes berserk, starts attacking people, and Whiskey Jack gets hit in the leg. And again, there's shouting in this gibberish language, Mammoth, and it turns out that he's been being possessed by the tyrant. Palin's still digging around in the garden, and he's like, it goes to where this thing is growing, and Tuanima has probably tools telling him that he has to defend this disaster thing. To kill it.
He uses his powers to help defend the Azath, defeat the Finest.
Tearing
it apart with his teeth, in fact. which is quite the thing.
It's quite it's another one of those cuckoos in the big red heels reading because they're like, oh, what the hell's that? And then that. And, so, my basic understanding is that this is that thing that grows up around the Finest. It kind of gets, also explained, later on what the Azath are, or is, but, basically, like, grew around this Finest and it's, taking over this garden. It grew from that acorn that, Lorne put there, so that's, where we stand now. Mammoth, next scene, Mammoth is still going berserk, and, so suddenly, and then, Quickman, like, summons all of his seven wards, Hedge fires his crossbow at Mammoth, and then, Crone shows up, giving us more of her, like, cackling, silly battle, and then we find out Mammoth has been like destroyed by this interaction between the Warrens and the that huge explosive that Hedge fired.
Yeah.
And, apparently Mammoth's dead and the tyrant is dead.
Quick Ben saved the witch twice as well during that battle, and also unleashed seven Warrens on the possessed mammoth.
Yeah. Wow.
Just more mystery around Quick Ben. So far, I think everyone we've met has access to one Warren. Because I think Tattersail, who was a high mage, was the Thea Warren, was it?
Yeah.
And I think Tayshrin similarly only had the sort of the one Warren, but this guy who's just a humble squad mage somehow has seven Warrens, three can access.
Yeah, it's quite odd that, like, and just using the thinking, in the in-universe thinking, like a guy with seven friggin' warrens is a squad mage. Like, I mean, it is the Bridgeburners and all that, but, still.
I think that's by design. I don't think he wants to draw too much attention to himself.
Well, yeah, but it's kind of odd. Like, yeah, if you were just, some soldier in this guy in the One-Arms Army, and you're like, oh, what? Like, this random squad mage lists, like, seven wards. Like, oh my god. That's, like, insane. Quick Ben is one of the, more, beloved characters, in the series for obvious reasons. Then, finally, the Bridgeburners realize that if they detonate the mines he planted, it's gonna, like, set off the gas, which is, used to light Dirigistan, and it'll destroy literally the entire city.
Yeah.
So, and then that's like whole damn city, and then it's like the end of the second chapter. And then the next chapter, Param meets a hound, Rude, and a certain man, Cotillion, the rogue who possessed Absalar.
Yeah.
And there's a talk about how the Param and the hounds are kind of related.
Yeah. I think it confuses the hounds because initially they want to kill him, but then they're like, oh, he's kin to us. Yeah. Because he touched the blood and saved, he did release the two hounds from the wagon inside Dragnipur. We don't know to what end.
This queen starts like shouting, like, oh, why did you possess an Absalar jerk? Cotillion leaves, and like kind of wonders if this is gonna run from Darkness, from the garden or with it, something weird. Paranau decides he's gonna go find Lorne. Now it's like, don't treat her kindly.
Yeah.
And then we have Crocus kind of traumatized by Mammoth's death. And it's like, even though he was, even by when he died, he was like no longer himself, but he was just running through like the chaotic streets, and like, his birds are fine. More Kripa looking for food, maybe this time in the kitchen. Then we've got Lauren basically realizing that Lauren's dead, and Jessica calls her the adjunct now, and she's just about to find Crocus, and she's moving really fast, and she summons a demon, Lord the Ghislaine, or whatever that is.
It's just another kind of demon, I suppose. He doesn't bother to sort of waste time describing these things. He's just like, oh, this is a demon. It looks like this, and apparently it's very powerful, but just take my word for that.
more Baruch, and Rudan, and this they've been warned. They realize that two of the Kabob have just been killed by Orkin. Wraith, and then we have Wraith talking to Kuul and Silana, and he's talking to Kuul, and he's like, and they kind of reflect on how it's been shaped forever, and to like live beyond your time.
Wraith kindly says that he'll try not to destroy Kuul's tower, which is the only sort of place in the physical realm where he can manifest himself. That's very good of him.
Wraith sees that the demon, who is apparently also a shapeshifter, who like a soul taken, and Wraith himself shifts into a black dragon. Another of those kind of Dragon Ball-ish movie parts.
And he's even bigger than Silana, who's the one true blood dragon.
So basically, he starts to fight the dragon, and with Kala moving on, we have I think is the last time we have Lauren, this time almost killing Crocus. Then he meets this this guy with a sword, and it turns out that he's been protected by the Crimson Guard the whole time, and that they, of course, they're commanded by Prince Kaz. So that's the prince that they were talking about to Serap earlier.
Yeah.
And now basically we get the entire arc gets explained. Basically, this Crimson Guardsman guy, Fingers, basically explains that the coin that Crocus has been carrying on all the time is like Opon's coin, so it makes him extremely lucky, which kind of breaks, but, he tells him that if his luck goes bad, to throw the coin, we have Lauren suddenly noticing she can't get to Crocus, and then she gets stabbed, and she sees she kind of falls, and gets stabbed by two women, she starts dying, and it turns out that one of the women is a niece, and immediately after that we have Paran finds her, and sad scene, and you do find yourself feeling a bit forlorn.
I felt sorry for her, because I think at the very start of the story she seemed quite a reasonable character. I think it's this Shades of Grey thing where none of these people are sort of outright evil. Maybe Turbinor. Raced seems pretty bad. But all the others are just sort of people who've got jobs to do. They've got a life to live. You know, she's following the orders of the Empress, and part of her orders included betraying the bridge burners and making sure that they died as part of the taking of the Rootstone.
Yeah.
But she's always been good to Ganos, and I feel a bit sorry for her. It's a bit of a undignified end for her as well, sort of stabbed by a couple of thugs.
I don't feel for her as much as some other characters, but she does touch a note. It's not like this kind of like this cartoon villain who dies and you don't care.
Yeah.
Not like Turbinor.
Yeah. And she does have a pretty tragic backstory as well. Her family was wiped out in the Mouse Quarter rebellion.
Yeah.
By that sales squad, wasn't it? They sort of burned the whole thing down.
Yes, it was, and they had that whole confrontation acting a fail, that is.
So then Arpon shows up and is really distraught that Paran gave their sword to Shadow Throne, or to Cotillion at least.
He's like, give it to your worst enemy. that's what Rick told him to do with it. When he left turns, give it to your worst enemy.
Yeah.
So yeah. Then we have a sort of a break diving to kill this demon. And then we have a poem which might have been written by Quickben, actually. Strange as it sounds, because it's credited to one Adaphon, and that's Quickben's full name is Ben Adaphon Delat, so who knows. That's without the Azath. I am the house imprisoning in my birth demonic hearts. Anyway, so that Crocus running to find a Baruch and wonder that Vorkin, and he watches this battle between Rake and Demon, he's like, for a moment Rake notices him and tells him that Brood has convinced me to spare you. Well, convinced actually the demon kind of makes an observation. That's the blood of Rake has the blood of Tiamat, it's like a shapeshifter. And now there's a bit of juicy stuff about the mother and light that coming forward until quite a bit down the road.
The demon's axe seems to be sort of light aspected in its
which kind of reminds me, light is not always good.
I like the way the perceived light as being a corruption of the dark. Normally, it's another sort of inversion where normally you'd have sort of light as good and dark as bad. But and certainly,
when you think about it, there was darkness first.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah. So then another jerk Ray kills him. Then another of the Cabal the mages dies, and the Durin Baruch leaves his estate, and the Vorkin enters and the attacks, Vorkin's got, I think she has, she got her title, no, she's a mage, she won't have it,
So yeah, Vorkin turns up and throws a dagger into Derridan, and she's about to kill Baruch.
Poison.
When Crocus turns up and knocks her out with some bricks.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's kind of like a kids' movie kind of moment, you know, where like the kid saves the day with a brick or something.
Yeah.
In the end, it turns out that White Parrot supposedly has no antidote, but Parrot, being an alchemist, has the all the antidote and lied about it.
Yeah. So then Crocus takes off.
Yeah. And he leaves and says, "Oh, I was just lucky, I suppose."
Yeah.
Then we have a bit of a wrapping up. Absalai wants to go home.
Fiddler and Callum are gonna take her back to her home.
Yes. There's a bit of a organization. The Crimson Guard is about to attack Peol, and the Seven Cities is on the brink of rebellion, there's gonna be a party tomorrow, basically a ball-up setup. Then Carl pops up at the end and tells him he's gonna help him get out of Burgistan.
And then we've got the bone phone again as well.
Oh yeah.
And Dujak reveals that they've been outlawed by the Empress. Taishrim was supposed to arrest them, but when the demon died, it put him into a coma.
Yes.
It's just logistics, really, with them getting ready for this crusade against the Panion Seer. They're going to go and have a parley with Aladdin Brood.
See you in a few months.
Yeah.
You know, we're only going to get to that book in a few months, but yeah, for now. Then we have Ralik in the garden. He sees this house has popped up next to Azath, and he's kind of like, you know, dead and stuff, and so he goes in, and Vorkin, guy wounded Vorkin, kind of also takes shelter and book enter there. And then some random just NDI poor lad who's apparently blood kin to Sirat. I mean, why do they have to have random names just because they're kin? But okay. So basically, so they started intoning and talking about light and dark, blah blah blah. Kripa shows up, and he's like talking to Crocus and Lilio. And like telling them, like, oh, this great, we're alive, hey, it's a new year. Reflects on, it's like, I think you have the wrong fair maiden in mind, but Krupp says, you know, life isn't fair. And then Krupp says, I'm gonna tell you all about it. And Merlia says, thus spake the eel, kind of like driving home the point.
Yeah.
It was the eel the whole time. And we have an epilogue talking about the rumors again. Yeah, you know, do it just how it's found, built on a rumor.
That's right, yeah, the rumor of the barrow.
Yes. And we have, bridge burners dive us off. The bridge burners, about to head back to, Pale North.
Yeah, and they sort of say goodbye to Fiddler and Callum. They're gonna meet up later. Something. Crocus goes with Fiddler, Callum, and Absalar.
And then we have Palin, like promising, is like thinking about Tabersdale again. So he will say, I'll come to you when Panion's ear is crushed. And then he's like, thinking he's imagining, but then it turns out that Tabersdale is talking to him.
Yeah.
And it's like, and also a nice little circle closing. It's like, look at me now, agent for the adjunct once, now a soldier, finally a soldier, which
is all he ever wanted to be, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, that echoes of Burlock when, you know, he says, oh, I want to be a soldier.
But of course, he's much more than that now. He's got all these kinds of weird stuff going on with him. He's kind of, sort of affiliated with the Hounds, and he's seems to be able to communicate with Tattersail over great distances psychically. And, you know, he's, he took a finesse to pieces with his teeth and.
Yeah, he's up there. Then we have we have Crocus, Callum, Fiddler, and Absalar, his tradecraft. And it's like Crocus saying, like, do you believe in luck, Callum? No, me neither. So he just throws the coin.
Yeah.
To Opon coin, which is a nice way to doff. And it's actually the last line to about Circle Breaker, thinking what it'd be like, no longer anonymous to the world. That's Guards of the Moon. So, thanks everyone for listening to this extra long, double length episode. And we'll see you guys in 2 weeks for the first 2 or 3, something like that, chapters of Deadhouse Gates. A shout out to your favorite bookstore if you haven't bought it yet. I promise it will be worth it.
Yeah.
As for technical things, the iTunes problem has been sorted out, so all our episodes are now available. And of course, this one, follow now, remember to post it on my blog. Please rate us on iTunes, and if you haven't already, join the over 70 people who have liked us on Facebook, just search for Miles on the Fam Podcast, or and comment on the blog, milesonthefam.blogspot.com. And that's all for tonight. See you guys in Deadhouse
Games. Thanks, everyone. See you soon.